and then Senate File 195, which is Senator Limmer. Because we have a second bill that we have agreed to hear today, I'm going to put a time limit on the time we're going to spend on this bill, and we will be concluded in about 45 minutes, roughly, so that we have time to take up Senator Limmer's bill. I've got a list of testifiers. I've got, I think, some pro and some con, and what I'd like to do is offer 20 minutes of testimony for each side, and we'll try to be pretty firm about that. This bill, by the way, we did have a long discussion about this in our hearing on the budget bill, so this is not a new issue for the committee, but we understand Senator Gerlach would like to have this bill go separately as well, which is why we are hearing it separately. And but I did want to put the participants who are on the list to testify that we are going to try to keep the time limited so that each side has a fair amount and allow us to be able to take up the second bill at about quarter or 10 to, let's say, 10 to 2. So, Senator Gerlach.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And as the Chairman mentioned, this was an issue that we did hear some information about a couple of weeks ago when the omnibus bill was being put together. And I was in the audience at the time because it was offered as an amendment, and I will say, I mean, I apologize for having to go through that process. It was sort of reversed. We ended up, the omnibus train was leaving the station. We had to, take advantage of that opportunity, and we had fully intended to have a complete hearing on this issue. So my hope, members, is that, because we had a lot of talk about the process on that, is that we could set that aside and focus on the policy of what this is about today, how important this is for healthcare, for nursing, and that we could go forward on that note. Well, the Nurse Licensure Compact, several years ago, a constituent from my district who was involved in a nursing organization called the Minnesota Organization for Leaders in Nursing came forward to me and said, "You're my senator, and here's a very important issue." And I began a sort of a multi-year odyssey in learning about this issue. My mother is a retired RN, so I grew up hearing about what nursing is all about. But and so I was interested in helping. And this issue then came forward. We were able to get an informational hearing without a vote in the policy committee 2 years ago. That was when Senator John Marty chaired that, to at least present the issue. And there's no question that not all parties are in agreement on this. I'll tell you that there's a long list of healthcare organizations that are for it, and the Minnesota Nurses Association, the Nurses Union, is opposed to it. It's the only organization that I'm aware of that is opposed to it, and that's what we'll be discussing today. Well, the Nurse Licensure Compact, it's a model of nurse licensure which allows a nurse to have one license in his or her state of residency and a practice in other states, both physically and electronically, subject to each state's practice law and regulation. Absolutely critical component. I'm hoping that members will refer back to as we hear testimony, that it is subject to each state's practice law and regulation. The NLC is a legal agreement between two or more states, in this case, 24 states currently nationwide, so about half of the states in the country are participating members. It allows the recognition of nurse licensure in good standing in all the states that have adopted the NLC. Under mutual recognition, a nurse may practice across state lines unless otherwise restricted. So how does a state become part of the NLC? Well, they have to pass into law the bill before you. And I will say that to this, as far as the idea of compacts, you may have heard on the floor of the Senate last week when the omnibus bill was up, this question came up briefly, and I pointed to a list of other compacts. In fact, I asked research to come up with a list of compacts Minnesota is currently part of, and there's a list of 26 different multi-state, some of them involve multi-province, because, of course, they deal with Canada, different compacts, and these are public policy matters that we, the state of Minnesota, the legislature, have deemed in our best interest to cooperate with other states for the betterment of our citizens. And members, I would say that this Nurse Licensure Compact is one of those matters. It is a public policy matter that, if passed, will be to the betterment of the nursing profession and also for the health care of our citizens. I mentioned that there are currently 24 states that are part of the NLC, and some of the other information on here is we'll cover in testimony. I don't need to reiterate all that. But I wanted to, if you have a sheet here that says the Nurse Licensure Compact fact sheet, on the back side of that, it lists who supports the NLC. And you will see a very long list of groups and organizations, and every day I'm approached with people adding their names to this list. Literally within the last hour, I was told by representatives of the American Red Cross that they, too, wish to be added to this list. So you can pencil that in if you'd like. Another bullet, the American Red Cross believes that this legislation will aid them in their mission. Now, it's a pretty important mission. So, members, with that, I would like to turn this over to Shirley Brecken, who is the executive director of the State Board of Nursing. And she can tell you about her organization and provide her testimony, unless any members have any questions of me immediately.
And members, I would we did talk about this before, and I would want to make sure we have time to hear all the testifiers. So if we can hold off on questioning until we're completed, just if there are questions, let's save them until the end. So please, Ms. Brecken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Shirley Brecken. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, and I thank you for this opportunity to give the Nurse Licensure Compact Bill a full hearing. There are several others who will talk about how they believe the compact will benefit their practice and the patients they serve. My intent is to address the regulatory and jurisdictional issues that have been raised by the Nurses Union. First of all, I have provided you with a written response to a memo that was distributed to the committee members on March 29th by the Minnesota Nurses Association. That written response addresses inaccuracies in the union's assertions regarding the board's authority to effectively regulate nursing practice, how it undermines patient safety, interference with union organizing ability, and a nurse's right to due process. I believe my comments sufficiently show the inaccurate representation on these issues. I would like to specifically point out that the Nurses Union proposes that telenursing can be accomplished in the same manner that Wisconsin has with a 72-hour provision. However, ironically, Wisconsin has been a member of the Nurse Licensure Committee for over 11 years. The Nurse Licensure Compact is predicated on the fact that all states have basically the same requirements for licensure. All require graduation from an approved school of nursing and passing the same national nurse licensure examination. This is actually the basis we currently use for licensure by endorsement. If a nurse is licensed in another state and comes to Minnesota to get a license, we don't require that nurse to prove this when coming to Minnesota. We endorse the license because the other state board of nursing licensed the nurse using the same requirements as Minnesota. The Nurses Union says the board under the compact will not know who is practicing in Minnesota. We don't now. What we do know is who has a license to practice. Because all 24 states are required to submit their licensure and discipline data to the National Nurse Database, we know who has a license to practice nursing in any compact state, and that would be true for Minnesota should we join the compact, whether that license is valid and whether it's been disciplined in any way. Employers are actually the ones who know who is practicing, and they are obligated by law to verify that the nurse's license is valid and unencumbered. The collective national database provides even greater information to an employer and the public regarding the nurse's authority to practice. The Nurses Union asserts under the compact bad nurses are able to jump from state to state. Unfortunately, that also happens now with states that are non-compact. However, the vast majority of nurses work very hard to provide safe, competent, and compassionate care to their patients. As in any profession, there are those individuals who are unsafe and determined to game the system for their own interest. The states that are in the compact recognize this very small number of nurses who seek a geographic cure and have sought to strengthen enforcement activities. The compact will help this state board of nursing do a better job of tracking nurses. All compact states must provide nurse licensure and discipline information to the national database. If a nurse is using a multi-state license and has a complaint filed in one state, all states in the compact have access to the investigation information if there is a risk of harm to the public. Currently, we have to wait until a state takes disciplinary action to know there is a concern. Under the compact, we will know much sooner and can provide greater public protection. Under the compact, if a nurse's license is encumbered, the nurse's practice is limited to that home state. He or she cannot go to another compact state to practice. And if the license is suspended or revoked, all privileges to practice in other compact states is similarly revoked. It automatically eliminates the need to take disciplinary action in the 23 other member states. The nurses union alleges patients won't know where to file a complaint. The patient will do the same way they do it now, file it with the Minnesota Board. The Minnesota Board will cooperate with the home state of licensure to conduct the investigation. Patients can actually expect better enforcement. The nurses union has alleged that Minnesota will lose the ability to adopt new requirements for nursing. The fact is, it is you, the legislature, that sets the requirements for licensure, and this will continue to be your authority under the compact. Ideally, the requirements should be the same from state to state. All boards of nursing, through the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, are working towards standardization of licensure requirements. To that end, the Minnesota Board of Nursing is, in this legislative session, seeking authority to do criminal background checks on all applicants for nurse licensure in Minnesota, something over 34 other states currently do. We just found out on Friday that the Nurses Union opposes criminal background checks for applicants for nurse licensure. In closing, I'd like to tell you to reiterate that licensure requirements for competence are the same. Graduation from an approved school of nursing and passing the same national licensure exam. Employers and the public will have access to greater information regarding a nurse's authority to practice under the compact. Boards of nursing who have enacted the compact are able to act more quickly and efficiently through shared investigations and similarly taking action. Patients who file a complaint can expect better enforcement. Enactment of this bill reforms nursing regulation for how nursing care is delivered today and in the future. Rather than decrease public protection, the compact empowers the board to do a better job of public protection. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brecken, and we want to bring up the next testifiers, so maybe if you could just be available if there are questions and we're done with the presentations. We want to make sure that the other side has opportunity to present, so please limit your comments to about 3 minutes if you can. Thank you. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is...
Could you bring the microphone up very close so that we can catch the comments on tape? You have to put it very close.
Here now? Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Joe McLaughlin, and I'm the Director of Nursing and Nutrition Services at Health Partners. Health Partners is an integrated system with sites located in the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Western Wisconsin. As healthcare workers, our focus is on what is best and safe for our patients. As the only Level 1 adult and pediatric trauma center hospital in the East Metro, Regents Hospital serves patients from adjacent states, especially patients from Western Wisconsin. Regions is a regional burn center, therefore, we also receive patients from North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa. Burn and trauma patients generally do not choose where they go to receive their emergency care. They are brought to Regions because we provide the services that can save their lives. Their care does not end when they leave the hospital, as they rely on us for follow-up care regardless of where they live. As a standard of care, we contact our patients after discharge from the hospital to ensure an understanding of home care instructions, ensure follow-up appointments have been scheduled, and provide support to patients and families. Post-discharge follow-up calls are made to every patient to ensure continuity of care after discharge and prevent hospital readmissions. Continuity and completeness of care is as important for clinic patients as it is for patients discharged from the hospital. Patients expect to be able to call to speak to their doctor or their doctor's nurse or email them a message. We are unable to determine which nurse might make or receive a call asking for care from one of our out-of-state patients. Patients expect nurses to help them in managing and coordinating their care, no matter where they are physically. This is especially important in these tough economic times. Licensure in multiple states is very expensive, requiring multiple licensures for all of Health Partners nurses. It does not support our goal of lowering overall health care costs when all of them have to carry these extra licenses. The Multi-State Nursing Licensure Compact Bill is an effort to protect the public and minimize unnecessary barriers to access safe and convenient nursing care. As a healthcare organization, we assess the skills of all of our nursing staff and provide extensive and specialized education. We are responsible to make sure that we have highly skilled and competent nursing staff working in all areas of our organization to provide the care our patients expect and deserve wherever they are located. Health Partners strongly advocates Minnesota's joining the Nursing Compact for the benefit of our neighbors, patients, family members, and friends that receive care in Minnesota but may live in neighboring states. Based on this information, I encourage you to consider the passage of this bill to ensure the continuity of care for all of the patients we serve. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Sharon Frinson, and I'm from Mayo Clinic, Rochester.
Could you please be brief? We've got about 10 minutes for four more testifiers. So.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
My name is Sharon Prinson. I'm a registered nurse and a nurse administrator from Mayo Clinic, Rochester, speaking on behalf of Mayo Clinic, its affiliated hospitals and clinics in support of this bill. I've been a registered nurse for 24 years and have worked in the roles of staff nurse, nurse educator, nurse manager, and nurse administrator. As an organization, Mayo Clinic and Mayo Health Systems represents 10 hospitals and hospital bed sizes ranging from 18 to over 1,100 beds. Mayo Clinic and the Mayo Clinic Health System value nurses and believe that nurses are a key contributor to the delivery of high-quality, safe patient care. I'm here to share with you that Mayo Clinic Rochester and the Mayo Clinic Health System support this bill, as we believe that it will help to promote public protection and improve access to qualified health professional nurses. The reasons that we are supporting this will be made in 3 points. Point number one, benefits of one licensure. Mayo Clinic has operations in multiple states, many of which are members of the NLC. Adoption of the NLC in Minnesota provides our nurses with the opportunity to share their expertise and nursing skills with our patients across the country more efficiently. We are all working to provide our patients with the best health care possible. As technology and health reform models, such as the medical home model, move forward, the NLC will provide clarity around newer mediums for providing care, such as telenursing or nurse helplines. We recognize that we will not be treating our patients the same in the future as we are today, and we need to be prepared to meet those needs for our patients and to evolve to accommodate new models of care. The NLC helps break down state barriers that are not relevant to providing patients with safe, quality care. Point number two, benefits to our patients. The NLC gives states additional authority in such areas as granting practice privileges, taking action, and sharing information with other NLC states. This is done via the Coordinated Licensure Information System, which is a national database that facilitates sharing of licensure, investigative, and disciplinary information. As nurses, we are accountable for complying with the nurse practice laws and other regulations in the state where the patient is located at the time that care is provided. This is similar to the driver's license compact and needing to obey the driving laws in the state in which one is driving in. Enhanced sharing of licensure information between states is a good thing for our patients. Enactment of the NLC does not change the state's Nurse Practice Act in any way. Under the NLC, states continue to have complete authority in determining licensure requirements and disciplinary actions on a nurse's license per the state's Nurse Practice Act. Point number three, national entry-level standard. We are committed to assuring the highest level of safety to our patients. The NLC does not change the standard of entry into our professional practice of nursing. We encourage our nurses to participate in continuing education for their practice, and oftentimes we provide those opportunities for them. In closing, Mayo Clinic believes that the NLC will help us best serve the needs of our patients while maintaining patient safety. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony.
Senator Hahn and committee members, my name is Pat Reese, and I'm very proud to say that I have been a registered nurse in the state of Minnesota for 45 years. I serve as a manager of patient services at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare, and I am here today to speak on behalf of my organization and the patients we serve. Gillette Children's provides specialty health services to children and young adults with disabilities. We are proud to be designated as a magnet hospital recognizing nursing excellence. In 2010, we delivered care to thousands of inpatients, we had thousands of surgical procedures, but in addition to that, we had 132,000 outpatient visits. Among those outpatient visits and an augmentation of our services is the telehealth nursing, and those nurses delivered more than 39,000 phone calls last year to our patients and families. Gillette patients come from every county in the state of Minnesota and 42 of the 50 states of our country, as well as 13 foreign countries. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this issue that affects nurses and the patients they serve. That is the Interstate Nursing License Compact, S-4-230. As a leader in nursing, I feel it is critical importance to come before you today and to support the passage of this legislation. The mutual recognition model allows a nurse to have one license in the state of residence and to practice in other states, either physically or electronically, subject to the individual state's practices and laws. That is the point that's most concerning to us. Children and young adults with disabilities often have highly complex medical conditions that require ongoing assessment and monitoring. One important element of the service we provide is nursing consultation by telephone. Approximately 11% of all of our patients come from outside of the state of Minnesota and require our ongoing care and nursing expertise after they return home. Nurses in our organization are concerned and challenged by the current licensure process. In summary, as a registered nurse and manager of patient services at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare, I wish to submit the support for the passage of the Interstate License Compact legislation. The issues and needs of our patients and families can best be met by this compact, and these patients benefit by having access to the expertise of the Gillette nurses who are most familiar with the uniqueness and care of the disabilities these patients pose. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next.
Good afternoon. I'm Lori Sisk from Sanford Canby Medical Center in Canby, Minnesota, part of the Sanford Health System. Many of the comments I have are the same as my colleagues, but I will cut to some of them that I didn't hear them talking about. I am a nurse that chief nursing officer in a rural hospital, and so I'm a person that gets into patients' rooms almost on a daily basis. And I can tell you the passage of this would increase the safety and access to care. One thing that I'm interested in is bringing specialized nurses into our rural practice, whether it's a colostomy nurse, a diabetic educator, some of those nurses that I can't hire because I don't have the volume to support hiring them. I'd like to bring them into our hospital to care for patients and augment their care. At the same time, in a rural place, I have a hard time getting nurses experience in emergency room and OB. I'd like to be able to send nurses to our tertiary centers in Fargo, North Dakota, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to gain that experience, upgrade their skills, and then bring it back to our rural practice. Another way that I think this would provide for better care is more cost-effective. Health systems are on enterprise electronic medical records. We have group purchasing where all of our supplies we buy, our equipment we purchase are together. So our care has become very standardized in our health system, and I'm sure a lot of other health systems operate that way as well. So it seems to me that this licensure component would be the last thing that we would need in order to be able to move nurses around in our health system to care for patients. Just the other day I was faced with, we have a small dialysis unit, unexpectedly had two registered nurses who needed to be on medical leaves. So I had some nurses within our system that were willing to come into our dialysis unit and care for patients, but they didn't have a Minnesota license. So rather than moving the nurses to where the patients were, I was actually faced with having to move the patients to where those nurses were. So I would really encourage you to pass this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Next. Hello, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am Karen MacDonald. I am here representing the Minnesota Organization of Leaders in Nursing, also known as MOLN. I'm a registered nurse and have been for 38 years and currently practice at Health East Care System. I'm going to cut my testimony short because much of what has been said is the reason why our board unanimously endorsed the Nurse Licensure Compact. We're very much in support of it, see that it promotes quality health care in Minnesota and the advancement of nursing as a profession. The one piece that I did not hear emphasized other than by Ms. Brecken was that the Nurse Licensure Compact also allows for additional measure of patient security or safety through the nurse's system of license verification. Compact states, share disciplinary information about nurses that is potentially harmful, situations that have arisen in their state, and that can be handled very proactively. The current regulatory model does not allow for information other than current licensure verification to be shared between states. So current regulation allows for action to be taken retrospectively. So MOLN leaders believe that the compact is good for patients, we believe it's good for nurses, and we believe it's good for the state of Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for letting me share the position of MOLN, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I hope the testifiers can stay while we complete the testimony in case there are questions. And I do have on the list four
That concludes all of the testifiers that I have for proponents. I don't know if there is anybody else, but then I just wanted just to say a couple of concluding sentences on the case for this legislation, if I could, and then if you wanted to proceed to other testifiers. Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I would just tell you there is a healthcare is changing. You all know that. You wrestle with this continually in this committee. We all do outside all the practitioners, and I deal with a lot of insurance issues in the Commerce Committee dealing with healthcare. We overlap in some ways. It's certainly changing. This bill will help us keep up with that change, and it is absolutely about doing the best we can for the citizens of Minnesota. The Minnesota Board of Nursing, its mission, it's not to back up hospital systems. It's not to back up labor. It's to serve the public interest and what's best for health care for Minnesotans. It's about patient safety and health care for Minnesotans, and they are strongly in favor of this legislation. And members, I would, I guess we'll hear some other testimony and then certainly answer to your questions.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach. I have on my list Eileen Weber, Cindy Schoenecker, Linda Hamilton, and Diane Scott, and would like to also encourage you to be concise. We do want to complete the testimony and work on this bill before 2 o'clock. So please identify yourself for the record. Keep the microphone close, if you will, so that we can catch things on tape.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Linda Hamilton. I'm a registered nurse, and I am the president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. MNA is the largest professional union in the Midwest with over 20,000 nurse members statewide. As you know, the MNA has long opposed the Interstate Nurse Licensure Compact. It continues to be controversial for our organization because it promotes regulatory changes that could result in real and potential risks for our patients and nurses alike. Today, you have heard from many healthcare corporations that telehealth is the future of healthcare, and the compact is the only way we can do that. We disagree with that claim. We believe there are far less draconian measures for addressing telehealth, including laws like Wisconsin's that allows a Minnesota nurse to follow up with a Wisconsin patient without having to purchase a Wisconsin license. In the past, it took many days to receive verification of a nursing license. But today, in the advent of technology, a nurse can get a license to practice within 24 hours or less. Our concerns with the compact can be summarized as follows. First, that patient safety issues. We do not believe that the compact adequately asserts Minnesota's jurisdiction over non-resident nurses. It weakens the ability of our Board of Nursing to identify all nurses who are practicing in our state, and it does not adequately protect our citizens from inappropriate or unsafe nursing practice. Secondly, there are differing standards of nursing practice. BIFACTO allows the state with the lowest nursing standards to become the standard for our state. Issues around due process rights for nurses, including concerns around confidentiality and inappropriate information sharing, and finally, new roles for the employer in regulating nursing practice that can impede our professional nurse's role as a patient advocate. Today, less than half the states have joined the compact, and many states have rejected it. Two states' attorney generals issued opinions that the compact violated their state's right to regulate nurses within their borders. Recently, compact administrators rejected the state of Indiana for trying to amend the compact in order to provide more protection for their citizens. This should raise red flags among policymakers that the compact most definitely interferes with the state's ability to effectively regulate nursing within our borders. I would also like to add that, for the record, Ms. Brecken had said that we oppose criminal background checks. That is not true. That is happening currently. We don't need a law to do that. That's already happening. But going back to the compact, for these reasons, we do urge policymakers to reject the compact as described in Senator Gerlach's bill. Joining me today to discuss in more detail our concerns is Cindy Schonecker, followed by Eileen Weber, and then Linda Mash. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton.
Please, Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Cindy Schonecker. Thank you for staying indoors with us today doing this. It's very nice outside. Since the development of the compact over 10 years ago, neither the compact boards of nursing nor National Council, the unelected body that developed this compact, or the spokespeople for nursing for healthcare corporations have produced any independent verification that there is an increase in patient safety when the compact licensure model is enacted, nor have any of these individuals or groups provided a single peer-reviewed, independent, evidence-based document supporting this claim. Though the primary function of the Board of Nursing is to protect the public from unsafe nurses, and we do not believe the world is rampant with unsafe nurses. Let me make that clear. All published information related to a positive effect of patient safety through the adoption of the compact has been produced by the National Council itself. This data is unscientific, anecdotal, lacks supporting evidence, and by National Council's own admission is based on individual perceptions, beliefs, and hopes, but not a single fact. There is one independent investigational series that shows the compact, in fact, results in decreased patient safety. This report included information from courts, from nurses, from state boards of nursing, from National Council, and demonstrates licensure model does make it easier for nurses to continue to practice in different compact states, even though they have been banned by another compact state. It was also found that nurses who had a compact license and were being investigated by one compact state were more likely to flee that state and set up practice in another compact state. The report found that the compact nursing boards actually dropped investigations when nurses disappeared, thus assisting unsafe nurses in avoidance of a paper trail. The compact removes all initial safety checks currently required by Minnesota law when licensing non-resident nurses from Minnesota through the application process. The regulation currently requires the Board of Nursing to verify the status of the nurse's license from other states and or the nurse's database prior to issuing a temporary permit. Before a full license can be issued, the information provided on the application that the nurse has done self-disclosure must also be evaluated before a permanent license. The compact kills the safety check by not allowing it to happen. Currently, nurses themselves are required by law to self-report any criminal history. The compact also kills the safety check by not allowing it to happen. Under the compact, the employer, in fact, will replace the board as the initial and only licensure verifying entity. There is no requirement for the employer or nurse to report this verification to the board, nor for the out-of-state nurse to report to the regulatory agency any self-disclosure issues. MNA challenges the assertion as well that by the Board of Nursing and its supporters that all is equal in education and the test passing criteria for nursing programs. These are inaccurate statements. The 2010 National Council Survey on Education Programs and Boards of Nursing showed wide differences in what they consider acceptable pass exam rates, credit hours, and clinical experience requirements for both LPN and registered nurses. The compact does not require an educational component to ensure nurses understand that it's totally up to them, that they must be, I am not going to hand these out, so don't worry, but this is just a very small example of the information a Minnesota nurse may have to know if she wants to practice in the four contiguous states. If she's a travel nurse, she will have to know even more than this. So I'd just like to leave you with that thought and ask you not to vote for this compact. Thank you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Weber. I'm a nurse attorney and first vice president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. In respect for your time constraints, I may turn my prose into bullet points.
That'll be fine. Thank you.
Okay. We have concerned about denial of nurses' due process rights. We feel the compact would deny them in two major areas: the disclosure of certain investigatory information, and provisions empowering the compact administrators, the executive directors of the boards of nursing from the other states, to make decisions about the disclosure of information. Under current Minnesota law, the Board of Nursing discloses disciplinary actions to the public, but not investigatory information. That data is not made public. But under the Nurse Licensure Compact, the Minnesota Board of Nursing and the boards of nursing in the party states would be able to disclose certain investigatory data before any final decision on discipline has been made. Once a board of nursing reports that investigatory data to the central information database called NURSIS, the data then becomes available in all party states of the compact. As a result, each party state then can then take its own action, its own investigation against the nurse in question. That would actually result in that nurse having to defend herself before or himself before multiple boards of nursing in multiple states. And to do so effectively, it would be wise for that nurse to then retain counsel. And if those investigations require hearings, probably involve retaining counsel that is licensed in each state. This is an onerous financial burden, and we feel that the compact unfairly would put on nurses. It could also require a personal appearance in each of the half of the states of the country that could possibly investigate this nurse. So we have significant concerns about due process. We also feel that the disclosure of this investigative data denies the nurse their due process rights to fully defend any allegations against them for the reasons I've already mentioned. And needless to say, the potential harm to that nurse's reputation to have that information out there before any discipline has been decided on is quite unfair. While the compact requires a board of nursing to report that subsequent dismissal, dismissal against discipline, if the board does not do so in a timely manner, the nurse then has a further burden in trying to get the correction of his or her record in place. Under the compact administrators would be empowered to make decisions about the collection and disclosure of information. Also under the compact, that same group, in conjunction with the administrator of the nurses database, would be empowered to formulate procedures for the identification, collection, and exchange of information. Those provisions certainly grant to the compact administrators the type of powers traditionally granted to administrative agencies, which must comply with the Administrative Procedures Act and the Data Practices Act. Finally, under the compact, redisclosure of personally identifiable information obtained from nurses by a party state's board of nursing is controlled by the laws of the state that contributed the information. In other words, if a compact state other than Minnesota contributed personally identifiable information about a nurse licensed in Minnesota, none of the provisions of Minnesota's laws would apply to prohibit the redisclosure of that information. the nurse would be denied the protections of his or her own state's laws. While the compact may appear to address the issues of mobility and telehealth, no other health regulatory board in this state has adopted a licensure compact for these purposes. They have devised other methods to address telehealth and mobility without undoing the state's authority in public protection. As this legislation will result in loss of individual due process rights and substantial financial burden to the nurses who are simply under investigation who have not been disciplined, we urge you to reject this legislation. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Linda Mash. I'm here for Diane Scott.
Could you spell your last name for us?
Mash. It's M as in Mary, A-S-H.
Thank you.
I'm the education specialist at the Minnesota Nurses Association. Having spent a number of years as a nursing faculty in the Minnesota University system, I have a letter by a group of nurse educators in the state that I would like to hand out to the committee. I would like to highlight significant points from this letter. Educators share the concerns of continuity of care and cost-saving issues in the current healthcare system, but revamping the entire regulation system for nurses as the rationale for the compact is misleading to the public. The authority for the practice of professional nursing is based on a social contract that acknowledges professional rights and responsibilities as well as mechanisms for public accountability. Nurses take this relationship with the public as patient advocates very seriously. Our opinion is that nursing's public accountability for assuring patient safety will be severely threatened under this compact. Nursing is a scientific discipline that values evidence in the conduct of their nursing practice. The Board of Nursing and others testified that the compact would increase patient safety. To date, there is no independent study that verifies this claim. The evidence to substantiate the claim of increased patient safety under the compact is simply non-existent. As educators of nursing students in the Minnesota system of higher education, we know that students are extremely concerned about securing employment in this current economic climate. We believe this compact further challenges entry-level nurses as students to secure employment in this state, which raises a workforce issue for Minnesota residents. As nurse educators, we are concerned about continuity of care, issues, and cost within the current healthcare system. Another fear we have as educators, preparing students for jobs primarily in Minnesota, is that we will lose nursing jobs in telehealth to other states or countries where nursing labor is cheaper and the standards are lower. There may well be other unintended consequences. I would urge you to consider carefully all of the complex implications of this bill and not vote for passage of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mash. Members, that completes the list of testifiers that I have, and I do want to allow for questions. We would like to have a vote by 2 o'clock. But I hope we'll give us enough time to answer questions. We do have another bill we'd like to hear. So if there are questions, Senator Sharon.
I do have a series of questions. I'm going to start with one for Sharon Princeton, if she'd be willing to come to the table and answer questions.
Yes, Ms. Princeton.
Thank you very much. I am noticing that in the series of supporting a testimony from the nurses, that many of them are nurse in the administrative branch of the profession of nursing rather than in the direct practice area. So I'm seeing this as an administrative interest. The Mayo Health System that you're representing is a medical model. It's medically led organization, physician-led organization. And I'm familiar with it because Mayo Health System comes across to my part of the state. So I was wondering, you may not be able to answer this question, but the testimony indicated that there is not a similar kind of expectation in the Mayo Health System that the medical profession engage in this kind of compact process. And as a medical-oriented, medical-led organization, I find it interesting that they're supporting through their nurse administrators this compact when they haven't led the way in their own profession. And I wonder if you might address that issue.
Ms. Brinson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in regard to the physician model, I am not able to speak to what their licensure is, as I am not a physician. But from a nursing model, we do try and partner as much as we can with our Mayo Health System sites. An example of that I would share just recently is we help host cardiovascular wellness fairs for community events within our various health system sites. And in order for nurses to participate, that may be from the Minnesota side to go into the Wisconsin side, they are required to have a Wisconsin license for that. And so we are supportive as an organization in this licensure compact in order to help promote continuity of our patients. A lot of the patients do come from the upper Midwest, and so we're able to provide more advice and support and counseling.
Senator Sharon.
Perhaps I wasn't clear. I understand the rationale that the Mayo Health System might want this for their nurses. I understand what they're saying. I'm just wondering if it's not good for the medical profession. They're a medically led organization. They haven't initiated this as a requirement in the medical profession. And I'm wondering if you can help me understand. If it's good for nurses, then why didn't they lead as a medical led organization with doing this for what is a similar set of problems, telecommunications, geographical changes in boundaries for the practice, the regulation of the practice of medicine, of the physician practice. And the reason I'm asking you to clarify this is because it raises a question in my mind. If it's not good for all healthcare professionals who deal with the same contextual circumstances, why is it that a medically led organization is driving this for a different profession, a nursing profession?
Ms. Princeton.
Chair and Senator, in regard to that component of that, there may be efforts coming forward. I'm not able to speak to that. I do know that when we have physicians that go to any of our major sites, the Jacksonville or the Scottsdale, that they are required to have a license there. It does take a great amount of time for them to have this and can actually delay care.
Senator Sharon.
That's my point. So I'm just curious as to why they haven't done that. And then I don't mean to pick on you, but since you're there, my other question is, it's not picking on you. It's
no.
Another issue that was raised is, which I have a great deal of concern about for the profession of nursing, sustaining its own, just like the medical profession wants to, defining who they are, what their scopes of practice are, what the educational requirements are. That there is some concern that with the shift to the employer for so many of the verification processes and that typically would be the Board of Nursing regulatory process, that they will lose their capacity to interface with administration in a way that says we are not this institution's advocate. We are the patient's advocate. We are here, and we want to be able to fight with you occasionally on behalf of the patient. That's what nursing practice does in interfacing with the medical profession or any other member of the healthcare team. They have an autonomy about them that allows them to advocate and fight for a patient and not go along all the time. And I heard the nurses saying that with these changes in controls and authority that there's a risk to us that the nurses would lose their job, or they might lose their ability to be able to stay powerful in that role that the community really is dependent on nurses for. Can you speak to that issue?
Ms. Prince.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I do not feel that that is a risk of a loss of autonomy. As nurses, we are here as vigilant guardians and strong patient advocates for our patients. We work as members of the multidisciplinary team and are a highly valued member of that team. I don't see that this is a bedside care administrative type of issue that it may be portrayed in, because we all have accountability to make sure that we are delivering the highest quality care possible to our patients. And so I see the nurses as becoming more engaged. In fact, the number of emails that I have received from staff at the bedside saying, "This is a very good thing. Thank you for testifying on our behalf," has been very enlightening. But I see us, regardless of what our role is, if we are a bedside nurse, an educator, a manager, or a nurse administrator, that we have an obligation to be a vigilant guardian for our patients and to help keep them safe.
Senator Gerlach, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just add something I think will help Senator Sharon and others as well, because this topic has come up many times, and that is, what would we stand to lose as a state of control over our own destiny, so to speak? And if I could just bring your attention to page 8 of the bill, section 2. And there's some very, very clear language right there, section 2, paragraphs A, B, and C. Section 2A, a nurse practicing a professional or practical nursing in Minnesota under the authority of this section that we're talking about, the Nurse Licensure Compact, shall have the same obligations, privileges, and rights as if the nurse was licensed in Minnesota. Notwithstanding any contrary provision in section, that's this again, the NLC, the Board of Nursing, that's the Minnesota Board of Nursing, shall comply with and follow all laws and rules with respect to nursing. It says, and it says that all such individuals shall be governed and regulated as if they were licensed in Minnesota. Section B, this NLC does not relieve employers of nurses from complying with statutorily imposed obligations. And then lastly, is section C here, it's the last one I'll read here, it's that this does not supersede existing labor laws. There's enormous protections to make sure that we don't completely give up our identity. We want to maintain all of those patient care standards, and we will maintain all of those. This is just going to allow for more flexibility in the healthcare field.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gerlach, what you just said in the bill doesn't quite click with what the people who have been testifying on behalf of the bill have been saying. If a nurse that is practicing in Minnesota or practicing with Minnesota patients who live in Minnesota has to follow all of the licensing rules and regulations of the state of Minnesota, then they would have to have all of the continuing education requirements that are applicable in the state of Minnesota. And yet we've been hearing other testifiers on behalf of this bill say that it only gives you a common point of entry. It doesn't give you the continuing education requirements that are in state law for those who would be coming to our state who are licensed in another state.
Senator Gerlach?
Mr. Hanna, I'm going to defer to Shirley Brecken from the Board of Nursing to address the continuing education issue.
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, what the provision is that the state of Minnesota Board of Nursing would recognize the license of an individual licensed in another state to practice in Minnesota. And so it refers to the practice of the nurse in the state that nurse has to abide by all the laws and, you know, regarding practice in this state. As far as the recognition of the individual license from state to state, it's somewhat like we have now with Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, and North Dakota. As you know, we have a border state provision that says the Board of Nursing has to recognize a license issued by that state as authority to practice in Minnesota. And so Minnesota does have experience with, and those states don't, for instance, Wisconsin does not require continuing education as Minnesota requires for renewal of the license. So it's addressing the original requirements for licensure and the practice of nursing in Minnesota. As far as renewal is concerned, I would venture a guess
In fact, I think it's my belief that nurses don't take continuing education for the purpose of renewing their license. They take continuing education because they believe it will enhance their practice and allow them to provide more competent care to their patients. So continuing education is a mandatory requirement for licensure. In no way assures competence. I would tell you that every nurse that's been disciplined in Minnesota, with the exception of those who lied about the amount of continuing education they had when they renewed their license, has met all of the continuing education requirements, and yet in some way they violated the law and had to be disciplined.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess that is my point, that a license could have been issued 20 years ago. It makes a lot of difference whether you've had any continuing education since you received your license or not. And in Minnesota, we do require it, and some of these other states on this list don't require it at all. So to me, that is a big difference in terms of the competency of those who practice in Minnesota as opposed to other places, that we would be automatically encouraging them to practice in Minnesota just because they had a license in another state.
Senator Higgins, you have a question.
Mr. Chair, now I'm confused. The sentence that Senator Gerlach started out with, saying that any nurse practicing here shall have the same obligations, privileges, and rights as if the nurse was licensed in Minnesota, Senator Berglund brought up the continuing education requirements. And if I understood what Ms. Brecken said, she said that the nurses in other states didn't have to comply with the continuing education requirements. But it seems to me very clearly that this sentence says they would have to. So I'm confused. Which is it?
Ms. Brecken?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I guess that what I would iterate is that what this is referring to is that individuals who practice in Minnesota will practice according to the laws and standards in Minnesota, and they'll be held to those standards the same as they would be held in their home state to the standards of that state. It does not speak directly to the requirements for licensure. In fact, what it speaks to is the practice, not the requirements for how someone is licensed. It provides for the mutual recognition of that license to practice in Minnesota in the same way that the current border state law does, which the legislature passed in 94.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Brecken, if a nurse has an obligation, you call it a requirement of license, is that not exactly the same definition of what an obligation of a nurse would be? Your practice includes, you know, the requirements of your licensure, does it not?
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I guess I can only say it again, that what the compact provides for is a mutual recognition of a license, the same way we're doing it now with states, with Wisconsin, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Iowa, which, by the way, Minnesota nurses don't have the same privilege that a Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota licensee has to come to Minnesota to practice under that current license. It is the standards of practice that are applied. The mutual recognition of the license is a recognition that the individual has met the requirements for licensure in a given state. It's very similar, I would tell you, to what the military federal system does. That is, if a nurse who works at the Minneapolis Veterans Administration Hospital has to be licensed only in a state, not in Minnesota. They can practice in that federal facility on a California license, on a Wisconsin license. They are not required to have a Minnesota license. Yet they're held to the same standard of practice in Minnesota as a nurse who's licensed in Minnesota. So it's a model that's currently in place throughout and has been for, I'm not sure how long, but it's longer than I've been practicing nursing, which is a long time.
Senator Gerlach, when we had the testimony a couple weeks back on the amendment that we adopted into the budget bill, and there was, we had a fairly lengthy discussion then as well. And I believe at that time you had indicated that you would be willing to try to work out problems in the bill with the nurses who had some issues with it. And I just wondered, have you had a chance to do that? And have, I don't, you don't have any amendments, so I just like a little update on what the results of those discussions have taken place.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this has been out for several years, but actually at the during the hearing, the representative of the lobbyist for M&A, Mary Jo George, she did say that they had some amendments. In fact, I think the letter that was written to Senator Sharon said proposed amendments, but it wasn't actual language. It was just concepts. And so at the conclusion of that hearing, I had a conversation in the hallway with Mary Jo George, and she'd asked me if it would be all right to use my name with the revisor or with counsel to draft some amendments. And I said, absolutely, go ahead. And I said, even if they're backed up and don't have time, if you could just put your words down, just tell me what section and what you want to do, let's do that before the hearing. Happy to do so. And she said, great. And then I heard back subsequently that she had no amendments and that no amendments would be offered and that they would just be in opposition to the bill.
Okay. Senator Rosen, and then I'd like to entertain a motion if someone may have one. So, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, would it be okay to ask Ms. Lori Sisk about if she could come up to
certainly, Ms. Sisk.
Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Ms. Sisk, can you tell, is there any way you could put a price tag on this? You told the story about having to move the patient to the nurses. How often does this occur, and have you ever put a pencil to how much this costs to do something like that?
Ms. Sisk.
Thank you. I haven't put a pencil to it. It does happen. We've split our health system up into a north region and a south region. And in our south region, we have 24 hospitals. I would imagine the north has, a lot of hospitals too. So I'm one person in one rural hospital. It happens several times a year where I would think, gee, it would be nice. I've got somebody in Wagner, South Dakota, in their dialysis unit in that example that could come and work. And so I don't have a price tag, but it's not something that is very rare. I mean, I butt up against this in my profession.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sisk, you talked about bringing in specialized nurses to practice in your hospital from time to time. I am not exactly sure I understand why you can't do that under Minnesota law today and why you don't. I mean, I understand that you're a system and you might prefer bringing in people from another state since the majority of your system is in other states, but it doesn't mean you couldn't bring people in who are not part of your quote-unquote system, and they could practice in your hospital when you have a patient that has special needs and could teach the nurses in your hospital how to deal with those situations in the future. That can be done under current Minnesota law, and I don't understand why you don't do it.
I'll go ahead and defer
Ms. Brecken, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, you are correct. There are two ways that a nurse can practice in Minnesota. The first one, of course, is to be licensed in Minnesota. So in this instance that you're describing, the nurse within the Sanford system wishing to practice in Minnesota would apply for a license in Minnesota. That process is licensure by endorsement. The second provision is the border state recognition law, which is in effect, which requires the board to recognize the license of a nurse from South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa or Wisconsin as authority to practice in Minnesota. There is a requirement in the law, and that was actually at the time, insisted upon again by the Nurses Association, that requires the nurse to be registered with the Board of Nursing and employed by a Minnesota facility. So that nurse would have to be employed by the Canby Hospital.
Even though licensed in South Dakota would have to first be employed by Canby and then to apply to the board for the to be on the registry. It's a fairly simple process, but it does have to be done ahead of time.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
And Ms. Brecken, and so it isn't a very costly practice to ask to be listed and to be on the Minnesota Nursing Board's list of practicing nurses. It would cost a lot less than moving a patient to another state, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think unfortunately the problem is that when that occurs, as Ms. Siska stated, the individual has to come from that other facility. Again, they wouldn't meet the qualifications for licensed or for being on the Border State Registry because they would not be employed by the Minnesota facility, which is a requirement in the law. To be on the register, the individual has to be employed by a Minnesota facility, must be a resident of the state in which they are licensed. In this case, let's talk South Dakota since that's what you're referring to. They have to make application to the board. There is no cost. You are absolutely correct about that. There is no charge for being on the registry. The employer is required to verify the license with the Board of Nursing in which the license holder holds a license and must validate to the Board of Nursing that they indeed have checked that license with the Wisconsin Board of Nursing. So I think the situation, if I understand what you're saying, is that it's a process they have to go through and they have to be able to anticipate it. It isn't something that they can deal with it as the patient crisis occurs.
Members, and I know we have some questions. I would prefer not to have to take up Senator Limmer's bill this evening, but I would like to try to have that be brought before the committee as well today. We did have a rather extensive discussion at our last meeting, and I would like to try to bring this to some conclusion. But Senator Rosen, you had a question.
Mr. Chair, I was going to move the bill, but I'm not sure.
That's what I was going to do.
Well, if Senator Gerlach, does this bill have to go to another committee?
Mr. Chairman, nobody has requested it, to my knowledge, unless they have from your committee. I've heard nothing, so I guess the floor.
So, Senator Rosen.
Then I would move that Senate File 230 be recommended pass and sent to general orders.
On that motion, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I would just, with your forgiveness, I'd like to have Ms. Brecken answer a couple of questions. Another couple of issues that I'd be interested particularly in your response to is the concerns that nurses have, this change from distributing information about somebody when disciplinary action has, in fact, demonstrated that a violation has occurred versus states having access to complaints and innuendos or suggestions that somebody's upset about something and applies the loss of control over data privacy. And the second, I'm still struggling. I wish we had somebody from the Minnesota Medical Association here as to why the push for the nurses to do this when other health professionals haven't. And if it's such a good idea, why aren't we seeing in the last two or three years the Minnesota Medical Association or the physicians from the Mayo Clinic who are pushing this, coming forward and pushing this for their own profession?
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I can answer the first question. I'm not certain I can answer on behalf of the Medical Association or the Mayo Health System. The Board of Nursing currently has authority to share investigative information with other state boards of nursing if it is in the interest of the citizens of Minnesota. The standard is fairly high, and the standard under the compact is also very high. It is significant investigative data that would result or could result in disciplinary action. It's not frivolous information that comes into the board, or it's, you know, a nurse didn't chart X number of meds, or a nurse didn't, sign off something in particular in the documentation. It really is addressing the movement of nurses being able to have the authority to practice. It's sort of like thinking about those 24 states, there isn't a border. that nurse has authority to practice in all of those states. And so it's important for the Board of Nursing in a given state to be able to have the information regarding individuals who might be cause for public concern. There are risk of harm to the public if they're allowed to continue to practice. How it works currently is the, let's say, I'll use two states. I'll use Wisconsin and South Dakota because they're both in the compact. If a nurse is practicing in Wisconsin based on that South Dakota license, she's a resident of, he or she's a resident of that state, and there is a complaint filed against that nurse in Wisconsin with the Wisconsin board. The Wisconsin board notifies the home state, we have a complaint on a nurse licensed in your state, and we are conducting an investigation. The home state agrees to let Wisconsin do the investigation because that's where it occurred, and that's where the complaint is occurring, or the violation, the practice behavior occurred. Wisconsin can take action against the multi-state privilege, in other words, say, We found this to be true, and we're going to revoke the privilege of that person to practice in Wisconsin based on that action or that, and notifies the home state that they have taken that action. The home state then suspends or encumbers the license of the nurse. That means that automatically in all of the 22 other states, that individual can't practice because once the license is encumbered, they cannot practice in those other states. So I think that, and of course, it's important for all of those states to know that an action has been taken or that an investigation is occurring so as to, because that nurse is authorized to practice in that state. As far as your second question, what I can tell you is that there was a report to Congress, a very recent report to Congress by HRSA, which specifically addressed multi-state practice and telehealth nursing or telehealth practice for physicians and nurses and other health practitioners, but it really focused on nurses and physicians. And in fact, HRSA advocated for the similar provision for physicians as the nurse licensure compact as a way of taking down barriers between states and the ability to practice. Additionally, the National Governors Association actually had a subcommittee that focused on telehealth, and at the conclusion of their investigation and their hearings, concluded that the nurse licensure compact, or a compact for other professions similar to the nurse licensure compact, would indeed take down the barriers, and advocated for it to be the model for the future. I would say, and I hope you would agree with me, is that nursing is generally more progressive than the medical community in a lot of ways, and especially for patient advocacy and access to care. And I think that's why the nursing profession has been a leader in advocating for the compact.
Thank you, Ms. Bruck. And before we act on Senator Rosen's motion, Senator Gerlach, on page 10 of your bill, there is a reference on line 10.10, July 1st, 2009. Is that the correct date, or is that something that was reflective of earlier language?
Oh. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's a good point, and it should, I think it should say 2011.
So, okay, well, then before we act on the bill, Senator Hoffman moves that line 10.10, strike 2009, replace with 2011. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion is adopted. On Senator Rosen's motion that the bill be passed and referred to general orders, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the point that Senator Higgins made earlier on page 8, line 14, it would be more accurate if the bill said that the nurse practicing in Minnesota shall have the same privileges and rights but not the same obligations. I was just looking. It looks like 9 of the states have no continuing ed requirements. I'm not going to propose an amendment to that, but it does strike me as not accurate language if they don't have the same obligations for continuing education and so on. Can you strike that?
On Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion carries. Thank you, Senator Gerlach, and thank you for your testimony. Is Senator Limmer in the room? Senator Limmer, welcome to the committee. I apologize, we're running a little bit behind here. We are going to, and members, just for your information, we're going to extend Senator Limmer a little discretion here and probably carry on about 10 or 15 minutes past our normal ending time. Hopefully we will have enough opportunity to understand the bill and take action on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File
195, yes.
195 is a project that was created by the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project. You members may remember that the Vulnerable Adult Act governs Minnesota's system to combat abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of people over the age of 18 who are at the risk of harm because of their illness or disability. In 1995, well, originally created in 1980, 1995, we did make some revisions, and we joined law enforcement, social services, and healthcare professionals in a framework of prevention reporting, and when called for, protection of victims. In 2009, there was a focus on financial exploitation. This year, we continue the mission of working across agency boundaries to prevent and respond to victimization of vulnerable adults. This legislation improves the court system in their goal of providing justice for vulnerable adults. It standardizes the penalty for assault of a vulnerable adult as gross misdemeanor. It makes the crime of sexual contact with penetration a registrable offense under the Predatory Offender Registration Law, and it strengthens vulnerable adults in the administrative process. It does so by allowing a vulnerable adult, his or her representative, to receive a detailed explanation from the investigation agency when the panel review makes no recommendation for change. It notifies a vulnerable adult when a substantiated perpetrator appeals their decision, and it also invites that vulnerable adult to submit information that would be considered in an appeal hearing. It creates better information about reports and investigations throughout the entire process. It clarifies the jurisdictions for investigating maltreatment. It modifies the term lead agency to lead investigative agency, and it ensures that guardians and healthcare agents receive information about maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. It also adds representatives from local tribal governments to those a county may invite to participate in multidisciplinary adult protection teams, all for the benefit of vulnerable adults in Minnesota. I have Iris Freeman here who can give a little more detail on the bill and perhaps even a little history. She's been following this a long time. And, Mr. Chair, I turn it back to you.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Freeman, please identify yourself for the record. Bring the microphone close so we can catch your remarks on tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Iris Freeman. I'm Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell College of Law. My professional training is in social work, and I've worked in vulnerable adult services and policy for 35 years. My part this afternoon is to describe the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, which is the group bringing this bill forward. And Senator Limmer, you did a fine job of summarizing the overall content, so I'll keep that very, very brief. But first, let me just put in focus, who is a vulnerable adult under Minnesota law? A vulnerable adult may be one of have one of two descriptors. One is, by category, they receive certain kinds of services, like nursing home services or services in an intermediate care facility for people with developmental disabilities. By category, they are termed vulnerable. But besides those, regardless of whether services are received, if someone is unable to take care of their basic daily needs, and over and above that are especially at risk of maltreatment and unable to protect themselves, they are functionally a vulnerable adult. So all of the references in the law to vulnerable adult are to those individuals. The Vulnerable Adult Justice Project is a collaboration of associations and agencies and viewpoints working together on vulnerable adult issues. And if you have a handout, I hope you do, or if we talk
yes,
to you,
members, we
there
have
is a roster of the associations involved and the agencies that have been helpful as well. One of the biggest challenges we have in the field of vulnerable adult abuse is that all of our work and our best practices and data really lag behind some of the other protective services arenas like child protection. In fact, when I started in the field in the 1970s, there wasn't so much as a law that mandated reports of abuse to protective services and law enforcement. That didn't come along till 1980, and it was April 11th of 1980 that Governor Quay held a ceremonial signing in his office of the very, very first vulnerable adult law. And I suppose I was 31 years younger, but what the heck? No, I won't show him the picture.
She's got a picture for evidence, Mr. Chair.
Look what I brought to show and tell. Okay. Senator Limmer described the fact that there are two changes to the criminal law around assault of a vulnerable adult and sexual conduct or contact or penetration with a vulnerable adult in a facility. The pieces that come before this committee are in the regulatory and social services side of protecting vulnerable adults, and here they are. In vulnerable adult investigations outside of the criminal code, the lead agencies that conduct the investigations are the Department of Human Services for facilities they license, Department of Health for facilities they license, and the counties for a great number of, for et cetera. And given the move in social policy and in your work to community care for vulnerable adults, the county's role just grows and grows. But when any of these lead agencies finishes its work on an investigation, one party or another in the case may not be very happy with the result. And under current law, there are formal administrative appeals for people who have a finding of harm to a vulnerable adult. But there is just one administrative review for the vulnerable adult herself or himself, and that didn't enter the law until the year 2000. The proposal before you today tries to even the scale by beefing up what that administrative review panel can do on behalf of the vulnerable adult, and also bringing the voice of the vulnerable adult to the administrative appeals that occur when a substantiated perpetrator wants more attention to the issue, to say, hey, you didn't get it all right. One of the things that this proposal does is permit for the first time a vulnerable adult to be represented in that hearing through their, either as a witness or through what's tantamount to a victim impact statement. And there is actually one amendment that Senator Limmer has to offer that brings this language into conformance with the agreements that were reached with the departments and the various advocates. On a much lower stress scale, the bill contains a number of simple edits, updates, and one grammatical change that needed to be made, but it clarifies the jurisdiction of the licensing agencies and the counties for investigating maltreatment so that the case gets to the right place in the most timely way, and that is a way of ensuring both economy in the investigation and timeliness. And so with that, I'm going to stop so that Ms. Castaneda, who is a practitioner, can talk about what this means in her work.
Before we do that, Senator Rosen, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to move the amendment, but apparently we
don't.
Do we have it?
Is there an amendment?
Amendment?
Mr. Chair, I have an A4 amendment.
Do you want to take that up now, Senator Limmer, or do you want to wait?
That would be fine, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendment, please.
Do we have that? We do not have the A4 amendment.
Dear.
Why don't we hold off, if you would mind withdrawing the amendment, and then we can continue the testimony, and we'll get that produced so the members can take a look at it. Please, Ms. Castaneda.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carmen Castaneda, and I'm the program manager of Hennepin County Adult Protection Services and a licensed independent clinical social worker. I've worked in adult protection services for 28 years and overseeing the program that receives and investigates vulnerable adult maltreatment reports of abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of the elderly and persons with disabilities. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, of which I've been a member since its inception in 2007. I'm not appearing as a representative of Hennepin County, although our agency is a member and a supporter of the work of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project. I'm here to seek to testify in support of Senate File 195, which is a bill that seeks to strengthen the Vulnerable Adult Act and related laws to better improve the public safety net for maltreated persons who are elderly or disabled. This bill merits support for the following reasons. First of all, Senate File 195 will provide representation to county adult protection units by adding a county social services representative on the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel at the Department of Human Services. That panel now consists of the Commissioners of Health and Human Services, the Ombudsperson for Long-Term Care and Ombudsperson for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and a member of the Board of Aging. The inclusion of counties would lend a better balance to this panel in reviewing requests from vulnerable adults when they disagree with maltreatment decisions made on them by a lead investigative agency, which includes county adult protection services units. Additionally, only county adult protection units investigate and make findings of self-neglect. And self-neglect is present when a vulnerable adult is not able to meet their own needs for food, clothing, shelter, and health care, and suffers from harm to themselves as a result. So a number of self-neglect maltreatment findings do get appealed to the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Panel with no current representation from the counties in deciding on these findings. Second, this bill expands the rights of vulnerable adults to be notified when a substantiated perpetrator appeals a maltreatment finding involving a vulnerable adult. For example, as a result of an investigation conducted by Adult Protection Services, a caregiver of an elderly person may have been determined to have forged the senior's checks or improperly used that person's PIN number to access funds from an ATM machine without the victim's consent. When the caregiver is given notice by Adult Protection Services that he or she has been substantiated for financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult, that caregiver likewise is provided information on his or her appeal rights to challenge this finding before a DHS Human Services judge. Under the current law, however, the vulnerable adult or an interested person acting on their behalf.
Excuse me, one moment, Ms. Kyle, could you bring the microphone closer to you so we can make sure
Surely.
We catch your. Thank you.
Thank you. They do not have a chance to be heard in presenting their side of the story, the vulnerable adult or their interested party. Senate File 195 would permit involvement by the vulnerable adult by allowing the vulnerable adult, a guardian or a health care agent, to submit a written statement to be considered in the appeal hearing. Third, Senate File 195 also ensures that health care agents receive information about maltreatment of a vulnerable adult when their duties are relevant to the protection of that individual. For example, if Adult Protection Services receives a report from a physician that an elderly mother who suffers from dementia is having prescribed medications withheld or stolen from her by a caregiving relative, new language in Senate File 195 would allow us to notify the vulnerable adult's designated health care agent, who might be another family member or a trusted friend. Early involvement by a health care agent can minimize further harm to the victim of maltreatment and allow substitute decision makers to better do their jobs. And finally, this bill lends clarity to the jurisdictional duties of each of the three lead investigative agencies that receive and investigate vulnerable adult maltreatment reports. Because the counties operate the common entry points, which receive and triage vulnerable adult maltreatment reports to the three lead investigative agencies of health,
DHS licensing, and county adult protection units. Senate File 195 would provide our staff with additional statutory direction as to which agency should receive which types of reports. Examples of new language in the statute that clearly states reports concerning hospice providers and home care providers would go to the Office of Health Facility Complaints. New language in the bill also would state that family adult day services, mental health clinics, and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program would go to DHS licensing. In summary, in this time of increasing vulnerable adult maltreatment reports and limited community resources, it is sound public policy for agencies to work collaboratively through the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project to pursue common goals that enhance protections for elderly and disabled persons who are the victims of maltreatment. Therefore, we ask for your support for the passage of House File 195. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Castaneda. We are distributing the A4 amendment, and I'm going to ask Senator Rosen to go ahead and make the motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendment, please.
Senator Rosen moves the A4 amendment, and I don't know if Ms. Freeman or Senator Limmer, do you want to just talk very briefly and tell us what the A4 amendment is doing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment clarifies the duties of the lead investigative agency when dealing with the vulnerable adult victim. Quite simply, if I can direct your attention to line 4, the lead investigative agency must consider including the vulnerable adult victim as a witness in the hearing. However, if the lead investigative agency determines that participation in the hearing would endanger the well-being of the vulnerable adult or not in the best interests of that individual, the agency should inform the Human Services referee of the basis for this determination, which must be included in the order. It's more clarifying language than anything else. We had put some new directions in the Judiciary Committee, and we were reminded that they needed just a little more clarification with this caliber of victim, and it's nothing more than that.
Okay, thank you, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, for the amendment, you might want to incorporate a line 1.2 after, delete everything after the first proceedings, because it doesn't make sense otherwise.
There's nothing after the second proceeding. Mr. Chair?
I understand.
Actually, could you incorporate in the both places on line 1.2 and in line 1.10?
Incorporate the phrase...
after the first proceedings. That
the first.
Term is in the sentence twice.
Members, incorporating the amendment are the words the first on line 1.12 and 1.10. Between the word after and proceedings. Thank you. Other questions on the amendment? Senator Rosen moves the A4 amendment as amended. I guess we didn't formally amend it, so just as it has been verbally changed. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Limmer. Are there any other testifiers or testimony that you wish to present at this time?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Just Senator Limmer, just wondering if you had any other testimony or any other presentation
to
make.
My testimony stands.
I'd like to see if there are any questions from members of the committee. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to move the bill as amended for Senator Limmer.
Senator Berglund moves the Senate File 195 as amended, and the motion would be, Senator Limmer, does this need to go back to the Judiciary Committee?
No, Mr. Chair. At this point, since there's no other amendments, we would be moving to the floor.
Senator Berglund moves Senate File 195 be referred to the floor on that motion. Senator Newman.
Is it okay, Mr. Chairman, we ask a few questions before we vote?
Please.
Thank you. I didn't know if you were going to call for a vote or not.
I will when we're ready, but please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm going to direct my questions to Ms. Castaneda because you are really speaking more towards the procedure and the appeal rights and so forth. And I've got about three questions, I think, that I wanted to direct to you. First of all, on page 4, beginning at line 4.12, we have got an adult maltreatment review panel that's being set up. And it indicates that the Commissioner of Health and Human Services is going to be on this panel or having a designee. Then it names an omnibus person, a person from the Board on Aging. And then it again indicates that a representative from the County Human Services administrators appointed by the Commissioner of Human Services. Almost seems to me like the Commissioner of Human Services gets two bites out of the apple here and gets two people on the board. And I notice in particular there is no local individual or local elected individual that is going to be on this board. And I'm just wondering, is there a reason why we don't have a locally elected individual like a county attorney or a county board member, and why the commissioner is put in a position to make that appointment to where effectively you've got two people sitting on the board representing the Department of Health and Human Services?
Ms. Castaneda.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I understand what you're saying, and I share your concerns, although I can't speak to how that was drafted. Can Iris?
Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, I can speak best to the history of the maltreatment review panel, and there are individuals here from the department if you wish to speak with them. At the time, we were the advocates for a review panel. We're looking for a way that a vulnerable adult who felt that an investigation just didn't result in their protection would have a way to say, you know, we need to take another look. And at the time, as now, there weren't a whole lot of dollars in the budget to start much of a new entity. And so this was conceived by its advocates as a paper review that would bring in all of the three lead investigating agencies, Department of Human Services, Health, as well as the Board on Aging and the two ombudsman programs, to talk together and look at the record and make some recommendations back to whichever lead investigative agency had done the work, and raise questions. Did you do this? Did you talk to this person? And so that is the background. The recommendation that a county official be added was one that recognized that in this day and age, 45% of the reviews are being done by the county. But don't have a specific reply as to the reason that the proposal for the county designee refers back to the Department of Human Services, other than that it was the understanding in drafting that a state-level agency would need to have the authority to make the choice.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
And as a follow-up question to either Ms. Freeman or Ms. Castaneda, either of you, on page 7, at line 7.6, we are setting up a system whereby a Health and Human Services referee is going to hear the appeal, presumably that's coming out of the review panel. And I've got two questions on this issue. Is, first of all, it seems to me that if the Health and Human Services Commissioner is on the review panel and then appoints somebody from the county level to be on the review panel, and then has a Health and Human Services referee to hear the appeal, it seems to me that there would be a direct conflict of interest in that. It just strikes me as awfully neat little package that all of this is occurring within the Health and Human Services agency. So your comments from either.
Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel deals with concerns or complaints from the vulnerable adult standpoint. They are the ones, or their representatives are the ones, who come to the panel and say, I don't think I'm being protected. The cases that are heard by the Department of Human Services judges or the Office of Administrative Hearings are appeals by people who were found to have perpetrated the maltreatment. And so they are not further appeals of issues that came under consideration by the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel. The review panel is consumer complaints. These hearings and the hearings before the administrative law judges are appeals by the perpetrator or by the alleged perpetrator.
One last question, Mr. Chairman.
Briefly, thank you.
Is there any reason that you can think of as to why we wouldn't be able to simply skip the Health and Human Services referee, avoid the issue of a potential conflict, keeping in mind that there is a notice provision in here for the vulnerable adult, and simply go straight to the contested hearing person that would handle it in the Office of Administrative Hearings? Any reason why we would not be able to do that?
Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, I can answer in part, and there are individuals here from the department and the Department of Human Services judges, but the kinds of cases, among all of those appeals brought by persons or agencies that have a finding of abuse or neglect or exploitation, among all of those, some of those are directed to the Department of Human Services law judges, and others of them go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And so, again, they aren't both ruling on single cases, nor is either of them in making a decision about a case that went before the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel.
Thank you. And then, Senator Berglund, are you?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just one other clarifying comment, and that is that the administrative law judges are a cadre of independent professionals, and so when you talk about one who is a human services referee, that doesn't mean that they work for the Department of Human Services. It just means they're a law judge that is familiar with the human services law area. So they are independent, and they don't have any conflict of interest regarding the Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Thanks for that clarification. If there's no further comments and discussion, I appreciate, members, your willingness to stay on and help us move the bill. Senator Berglund has moved that Senate File 195 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is carried. And thank you, members. Thank you, Senator Limmer. We are adjourned.